You're with Truth News Radio Australia on Wednesday, the 21st of July, 2010. I'm Hereward Fenton, and I've got two interviews coming up tonight. The first one in about 15 minutes. We're going to get into the subject area, which we've covered a few times before, of the drugging of our kids via psychiatric procedures, which are invasive, to say the least. And that discussion is going to be with Kim Cullen, who is a representative of a group here in Australia who is working to help prevent the interference in growing children and adolescents by the medical fraternity, who basically identify them as having psychiatric disorders, and in many cases now they're being drugged without even the diagnosis of a psychiatric disorder under the moniker of early intervention. Anyway, that's coming up. In the second half, we've got a guest returning to the show who we haven't spoken to for about a year. It's Jarrah White. Jarrah White, JW Studios, the producer and creator of a number of YouTube videos, which go under the name Moonfaker. If you put that into YouTube, Moonfaker, you'll soon find out what Jarrah White is all about. Interesting stuff, and I'm going to be asking him a few questions and catching up on some of the latest developments in his research. Now, for the next few minutes, I'll just cover some of the main stories that have been building up this week. Okay, on the free speech front, Facebook deleted the Alex Jones fan page, and YouTube removed, or someone hacked YouTube and removed the Alex Jones movie, The Obama Deception. And there's a whole lot of discussion about that over at prisonplanet.com. And apparently, in regard to the Facebook deletion, it says here in an article at Prison Planet that the flag, known as the Gadsden flag, which is a flag that has the snake on it that says, "Don't tread on me," apparently pages that have this image are being removed from Facebook. And this sort of comes in the wake of all kinds of ominous signs of government interference with the bill that Joe Lieberman wants to pass with the ability to shut down the internet. We appear to be moving into a new phase of more direct censorship and direct interference in free speech activities. So there's not a lot that I can add to that story other than the fact that we'll put those links up on our notes, and I certainly would want to keep an eye on anything that starts to affect websites here in Australia. And this, of course, an example of that, I should add, is the story that we covered last week, which is the Australian Vaccination Network being pressured by the ACCC, the Health Complaints Commission, to put disclaimers on their website. And it made me wonder if they can do that, if they can get away with pressuring. People who run independent websites to put disclaimers like that, well, truthnews.com.au could receive some kind of complaint, and we might be forced to put a disclaimer on our site saying, this is not a news site, or, we are an anti-government site. It's ludicrous, but if they can do it in one case, then that opens the door to more infringements of people's rights in this way. Airport body scanners reveal all, but what about when it's your kid? This is a story from Florida, and it's quite chilling because it really shows you the harsh reality of what these body scanners involve. So I'll just read to you a bit here. There's been a lot of talk lately about body scanners, the new airport security tool that allows screeners to see through clothes. People are concerned about privacy, delayed flights, and health effects. Now there's another concern. What about kids? Do they have to go through this too? And what are their parents' rights? A Baltimore family is raising the issue after their 12-year-old daughter was pulled out of line in Tampa and subjected to what they say was an embarrassing and unhealthy scan. The girl was traveling with an adult friend of the family, not her parents. Our daughter was scared and didn't understand what was happening, said Michelle Nemphos, mother of the girl. She declined to give her daughter's name. In essence, they conducted a strip search on a 12-year-old girl without her parents present to advocate for her. Now, the girl tells her story in a phone interview, and she says, I was coming home to Baltimore, and I was with my friend and her parents, and I was going to this airport security check. I put my bag through, and they pulled me aside and told me to go over here. I thought it was some high-tech scan, and I walked right through it. And this lady said, hold on, you can't just walk through this thing. Put your feet on the yellow footsteps and make a triangle above your head. I heard a beep and they said, okay, you can leave. I heard one of the guards say affirmative on the female. Now, the article kind of goes into the fact that her parents were ultimately quite outraged at what had been done to their daughter, and they're also aware of the health dangers of this equipment, and they're actually involved in trying to pursue legal action. Now, I'd like to point out that these scanners, which are now being rolled out across the US, these scanners are actually an alternative to another form of security check, which is equally offensive and invasive, which is what they call a full body pat down. And that's just not, that's nothing like just a quick sort of check of your pockets. That's actually a TSA officer basically touches every part of your body, feels every part of your body into every crevice, every nook and cranny. And they call that a full body pat down. And that's your alternative to going through the body scanners. I mean, how invasive is that? How demeaning is that? And this is actually done in public. And a lot of people, of course, don't like that. And you can opt to have it done in a private room. But of course, if you do that, it takes a really long time and it just massively slows everything down. Now, even though the scanners take a long time, the alternative of going through this you know, really humiliating process of having someone feel you up over your whole body, I think a lot of people probably opt for the scanner. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty tough choice, isn't it, between those two? That's where things have reached in the US. They've reached that stage where that sort of invasion, that sort of humiliation, that degradation has now become totally standardized. And there are plans to bring this technology into Australia and to implement it. And it will be implemented probably in the same way. I mean, if they're going to do full body pat downs there, why wouldn't they do them here? But what we see is an incremental approach. And at the moment, when you go through the airports, you get the bomb check, and they sometimes take a swab, and they sometimes make you walk through the metal detector three times, and a whole bunch of irritating things like that can be done. And of course, once they bring in the scanners, that will be another layer, and we are under threat, ladies and gentlemen. We really are under threat by this amorphous, pervasive, bullying state apparatus, which and we, you know, we wonder about it. We often find myself getting into discussions about where is it actually coming from. Who's driving it? What's their real agenda? We don't know. And we can't really afford to waste too much time speculating on that. It's like, when your house is on fire, you can't sort of worry too much about how the fire started. You know, and the fire's just racing through one room after the next and the curtains are going up, and you can't sort of sit there going, well, was it really deliberately lit? You know, how much of the house will burn down? You've basically got to put the fire out. And I think with this type of phenomenon that we're seeing, the time has come where we just have to put the fire out. We have to actually mobilize large numbers of people. We have to get mass protests happening to oppose things like the full body scanners. But it's only one. See, the full body scanner is only one prong in the multi-pronged attack on our rights. And we've got to realize that, and we've got to put energy into it, as well as putting energy into all the other fights. It's full engagement now. We basically have to realize that we're being attacked on multiple fronts. We've got to fight back on multiple fronts. That's at least where I see the current situation is. Now, I just want to play you a quick clip here from YouTube. This is actually coming from Russia Today on YouTube, and it relates to the AIDS equals HIV controversy. And there's actually been a few stories posted on Russia Today, and most of those are on our Twitter feed, and we'll put show notes. But I think there's been an alternative AIDS conference held recently, and a lot of people are speaking out. And the particular audio I'm about to play you is actually from I think it's a gynecologist who's, you know, an expert, and he's talking about the exaggeration of AIDS in Africa, misdiagnosis, and what he's pointing out is that what is being defined as AIDS in Africa is largely just poverty. It's the situation of poverty, but it's being addressed not by giving people clean drinking water, which would be the first step to help people improve their health and get out of poverty. No, instead, people are being offered drugs. And in a situation where people are already on the edge and suffering from all kinds of nutritional problems, to be handing out these types of drugs could possibly be actually a cause rather than a cure of disease and, you know, death. So I'll just play this audio for you now.
And AIDS. Let's now speak to Dr. Christian Fiala, who joins us from Vienna. Dr. Fiala, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, I understand that you believe the UN's HIV figures are actually overblown. What makes you so sure about this?
Well, I studied in depth the underlying diagnosis and the processing of these figures. And it is since more than 10 years that I have pointed to the fact that the basis of these figures, especially from Africa, makes no clinical sense. The so-called Bangui definition, which is the AIDS definition in Africa, is useless from a clinical point of view. And I am mainly a clinician. And then these figures have been blown up by UNAIDS in Geneva just to scare the people and to scare the world population any benefit.
But surely the figures speak for themselves, that people are dying in Africa and throughout the world from HIV/AIDS, aren't they? I mean, are you saying that, in effect, that AIDS doesn't exist and that this is some sort of conspiracy?
People are dying, and they are mainly dying as a consequence of poverty. If you look at Africa, people are poor. What do you expect people to do when they are poor? Obviously, they die. But mortality in Africa has been stable or even gone down, and the population of Africa has doubled within the last 20 years. So obviously, we don't have an epidemic of a deadly disease in Africa. The biggest problem, cynically, in Africa is population growth. And we are not helping people there to limit their fertility. And the second problem is poverty. Almost half of the population has no access to clean drinking water. So when people call for universal access for drugs, I ask myself, where is the call for universal access to clean drinking water?
I'm just going to pause it there. There's a bit of a problem with the audio. That signal is actually, that annoying sound is actually in the audio. But it's still very much worth watching, and there are other videos that you can watch on this topic, and we're going to be covering it again soon on Truth News. We did a whole show on it last year. We interviewed Brent Leung, who made the film about AIDS, which I just can't remember the title off the top of my head. And I'm hoping to get a copy of that soon to actually have a look at it and possibly screen it in Sydney. So, this again is just one of these huge topics, one of these huge controversies, which is not being properly addressed by science, and the media has consistently looked the other way and very occasionally covered it. For example, Thabo Mbeki, the former leader of South Africa, had made similar statements to this man we were just listening to, that that AIDS in South Africa was actually just poverty, and that that what we needed was better food, better general health, not drugs. And not saying that in some cases drugs aren't very important and lifesavers, but in this particular case, the medicines, as they call them, that are given for people who are HIV positive are, and this is acknowledged, they are extremely toxic. I mean, that, you know, they have a skull and crossbones on the bottle. Healthcare workers are supposed to wear gloves when they touch it, and you know, it's a form of chemotherapy. It's very destructive to human tissues, and they say it's justified because, you know, AIDS being a killer disease, in the same way that cancer is, sometimes you have to take extreme measures. And of course, they claim that the treatments have improved over the years. But look, I'm going to have to pause there because we've got our interview coming on momentarily. So please stand by for our first interview of the night. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Okay, welcome back to the show, and at this point it's my great pleasure to welcome to Truth News Kim Cullen, who is the Executive Director of the Citizens Committee on Human Rights in New South Wales. She has been a volunteer with this organisation for 10 years and has worked with a dedicated team to help expose the dangers of psychiatry and their alliance with drug companies. CCHR is a chapter of an extensive network of CCHRs worldwide. Kim works closely with Jan Eastgate, the international president of CCHR, who is well known for her work in exposing the atrocities of Chelmsford Hospital and having deep sleep therapy banned in Australia. Ms. Eastgate is the author of the article we are to be discussing tonight, which was published in the June-July edition of Nexus magazine, The Brave New World of Pre-Drugging Kids, Patrick McGorry and Psychosis Risk Syndrome. Kim Cullen, welcome to the show.
Hi, mate. How are you?
Yeah, great.
Thank you for having me.
Great, great. Yeah,
I just wanted to say before we started, it's actually in the New Dawn magazine. My mistake on that.
Yes.
So if anyone wants to actually see the original copy, it's in the June-August edition of New Dawn.
No problem. Yeah, we'll put that up on our show notes. I'm actually looking at it here. It's the New Dawn magazine.com.
That's and right. David Jones is the editor of that. Fantastic guy.
And the article is by Jan Eastgate. Now, Kim, you've been involved with some activities that we've run. You came to our film screening that we did last year on the Generation RX, and we've interviewed Rochelle McCready, lawyer human rights advocate, and we've discussed quite a lot of these issues, and we've talked about Patrick McGorry, Australian of the Year, a man who's being heavily promoted by GetUp.org as a somewhat a hero who's involved in supposedly helping kids, and he's even done like a lot of television commercials where we see him kind of like, you know, pleading with the general public and to help. And he comes across as someone we should be kind of, all kind of worshipping. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? And yet
it is really interesting, isn't it?
And yet we look into it, and we find that he's promoting things that just don't seem to, it doesn't seem to add up from a human rights point of view.
Absolutely. The scary thing is like, I think this is fairly common in our society, is that people listen to what other people are saying. We're listening to our doctors, we're listening to our politicians, and we're not actually looking ourselves and seeing what is the research that's happening behind this, what is the real situation, you know. So we're not actually, you know, we're too busy sort of taking everyone else's expert viewpoint without looking at it and deciding for ourselves. And I really applaud what you guys are doing, because you are shining the truth out on the lies,
yeah,
and what's happening out there. And people need to see that there's a lot of, you know, wool being put over our eyes, and we're being led, you know,
yeah,
led to the slaughter like lambs, per se, you know, without knowing what's actually happening. And this whole thing with McGorry is just a pointing fact of that, I think, Hewitt, because what's happening is,
yeah,
that he was given an Order of Australia Medal,
right,
this year, which is a very prestigious award. And actually, one of our commissioners, the Reverend George Capsis, who's a Baptist minister, he has a similar award for the work that he's done with, you know, people who have gotten out of mental health, mental hospital, you know, psych hospitals, and he's helped a lot of people. So it's sort of like, I know it's a very prestigious award, and usually when someone gets that award, you look up to them and you think, oh my goodness, you know, this person must really be doing some fantastic stuff, you know. But
it's very hard for the average person to get their head around this, and we come off sounding like conspiracy nuts, because we're basically challenging the whole worldview in saying, well, this person who's actually being held up as a symbol of everything that's right is actually doing everything that's wrong. And I mean, let's just systematically go through what this guy is actually doing and why we think it's wrong.
Okay,
so,
that's good. And I think looking at the article is just going to give us that, because, like, for example, we just have to look at the statistics for a start. The way our organisation gets our information is we research, and we do the research on the internet, and, you know, in the libraries, and we actually go and we find the data and we summarise it. So we're not, you know, pulling stuff out of the blue and just making it up. We do freedom of information requests, like, for example, to the Therapeutic Goods Administration. And we found out that an estimated, for example, 1,900 Australians under the age of 19 have died while on antidepressants and antipsychotics. That's 1,900 kids, you know.
And that's acknowledged in their figures.
That's from the TGA. We've got the documentation. You know, anyone can have a look at it. And more than 30,700 under 18-year-olds were prescribed antidepressants in 2007 to 2008, including, this is what really scares me, 550, 5 years and under. Now, side effects of these drugs include hallucinations, hostility, psychosis, and suicide. Now, what I'd like to know is, how the hell can someone diagnose a five-year-old or under with depression? I'm a grandma, right?
Yeah.
I've got two grandchildren, one 6 months old, and one is four and a half. Now, the four and a half, he can get a bit sad sometimes if he doesn't get his own way, you know?
Yeah,
and he'll
go
around and he'll sort of be, oh, you know, I'm really, you know, no one likes me, blah, 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 right?
Sure.
But it's like, what's it take to bring a four-and-a-half-year-old, make them happy again? You take them up outside, get a ball, kick the footy around, go for a walk, look at things, do you know? And,
and
how can you say a kid that age is depressed? The other thing as well is, I'm a teacher by trade, so I've taught these kids, you know, for 10 years I was teaching, and I've not met a depressed child that I can't take out and help and bring them so that they feel happy again. We're just looking in the wrong direction for this, I think. The other point with the TGA is, so this is just the background data, right, on where this comes from.
Sure.
We're looking at, during that same period, more than 9,300 children under 18, some as young as one, were prescribed antipsychotics. Now, this cost the government $3.4 million. And of the 477 deaths reported to the TGA, the Australian Therapeutic Goods Administration, which is like similar to the Food and Drug Administration in the USA, right? They're the organisation that approves the drugs that are put on the market. So, you know, of those 477 deaths, 15 of them were from ages 0 to 19, including babies who died in the womb. So, and the horrible thing there, again, is that only about 1% of the adverse drug reactions are reported to the TGA.
Right.
So the deaths could, you know, there was 15 deaths between 0 and 19, so the deaths could be as high as 1,500, you know. It's really scary statistics when we look at this, because what we're doing is we're giving our kids, you know, psychotropic, mind-altering, dangerous drugs, and kids aren't committing suicide on these and being violent.
Now, so, Kim, when it says 477 deaths were linked to antipsychotics,
absolutely.
Does that mean that those deaths were not, obviously, there wasn't like people being killed in car accidents or, you know, it was, these people were killed either by suicide or, is there any actual data on how they died?
Heart attacks, you know, all sorts of different. I've got a whole file of them. You know, you can go through it and have a look at it if you wanted to.
Right. So it actually
but there's a whole list of different things.
It actually lists the cause of death too, does it?
Yeah, lists the cause of death.
It's
really, really quite scary. You know, it's like some of the common side effects of these antipsychotics. You know, weight gain. You put on a lot of weight with it. People would really be reality. You know, have a lot of reality on that. Life-threatening diabetes. There's an irreversible neurological effect called tardive dyskinesia.
Ah, yes.
And basically that's when people twitch, you know, they can't control their twitching and tongue movements. There's also another adverse effect called neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and that can cause sudden death. So, you know, there were 14 incidents of 10 to 19-year-olds experiencing this neuroleptic malignant syndrome, right, and that was reported. Something, if a parent knew that their child could have these side effects if they were given these drugs, you know, surely you do your research on it and find out, well, am I going to give my kid this drug or not, no?
Totally.
Yeah. So back to McGorry. So this is just like a bit of background stuff.
Sure.
But looking at what McGorry's doing, he's actually got this centre in called Oregon, and it's part of the Headspace, which is a youth mental health chain.
Yeah.
And since he's been awarded his medal, Australia of the Year medal, he's just asking for more and more money for his centres. Now, you know, I don't know exactly what they do in the centre. I know obviously the bad things that they do, but there might be some good stuff as well. You know, I'd actually have to go in and have a look at it. So I'm not going to attack the centre as being totally, really terrible. But what we at CCHR really disagree with is that he's promoting kids being put on antipsychotics and antidepressants. He not only promotes them being put on the drugs, but he promotes drugging them before they've even developed a psychiatric disorder.
That is quite extraordinary.
I
really just want to emphasise that for our listeners.
Sorry?
I just want to emphasise that for our listeners. I mean, this is really being proposed that children who have not even been diagnosed, and supposedly, you know, depression and psychosis and these things are medical conditions, which, you know, supposedly you know, biological, yet, you know, the methods of diagnosis have always been very behavioural, and there's never been any actual blood test or anything that can show that you've got depression or schizophrenia or any of these things. But and yet, even so, they're even now taking it one step further. They're basically saying that all those behavioural diagnoses, which is part of the, you know, the DSM manual guide to diagnosis of mental diseases, they're going to throw that out as well.
Yeah.
They're basically now going to just say, well, you know, Johnny's a little bit withdrawn. Let's quickly put him on the drugs now, because we're going to, you know, it's early intervention. We'll just get him on the drugs now, because he might end up developing the full-blown, you know, depression, even though we can't actually get away with diagnosing it yet, because he doesn't actually meet the criteria. You know, he might be a little withdrawn, but he might be doing well in school. He might be, you know, doing a whole lot of other things that are totally good, and he's just a little bit withdrawn. Oh, let's put him on the drugs. I mean, that's the way I see this being applied. I don't know if that... Does that sound like the sort of scenario that's going to?
It certainly does. It's you know, Brave New World. Anyone who's read, you know, Huxley's Brave New World.
Yeah.
This is where it's heading, and it's like, you know, it's like you're talking about conspiracy theories before. It's like, yeah, there's no conspiracy theory in this. This is the fact. This is what's happening now, and people just need to wake up and look at it and see that it's actually happening. You know, you've got this group in America. It's called the Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Programs, right? It's a big name, but it's right. Basically what they're saying is what he's doing is similar to performing mastectomies on women who are at risk of but do not have breast cancer.
Okay.
So, you know, if your mum's, you know, at risk of having breast cancer, well, you know, let's get her boobs cut off because that's going to handle it, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, we can think of a whole lot of other scenarios for that as well, which are just as ridiculous.
Yeah, that's an excellent analogy. Yeah, and it just highlights how absurd it is.
I know, it is. It is absolutely absurd. It's, you know, I mean, we can go on about it because it's like there's a Richard Gosden who wrote a book called, I've got it here, it's called Punishing the Patient, and he's a Australian. He actually works at the Newcastle University or somewhere like that, but he's a fantastic guy. I went to a seminar that he did years ago, but he's a highly respected Australian author and academic, and he pointed out that so-called preventative medicine might be variously seen as unnecessary expansion of social control,
right,
a threat to human diversity through the enforcement of hypernormality, a violation of human rights, and a marketing ploy for the new generation of atypical neuroleptic drugs. And he wrote that in 1999. Do you know what I mean? Come on. It's exactly what's happening. This is what it is.
And, you know, we've seen...
Social control.
And in the list of drugs you were referring to there, you didn't mention Ritalin. And we've seen with a generation of kids that were put on Ritalin, this was... to dampen down their excessive enthusiasm. It seems like they want kids to basically conform to a really narrow range of behavior. So if you're too agitated, you're jumping around the classroom too much, well, that's an illness called attention deficit disorder. If you're too quiet, well, that's actually depression. And if you're too imaginative and you're coming up with all kinds of wild, you know, ideas, well, you might be psychotic. I mean, it's compressing what the accepted range of human behavior is down to a tiny little narrow range, and they're saying that's what we have to be.
And how normal is that?
Yeah.
How normal is normal?
Yeah.
What is normal?
And I mean, I've heard anecdotally from people who've actually been studying teaching that the Ritalin is often given in schools to kids without proper medical supervision. In other words, the headmaster has a drawer with pills in it, and when certain kids play up, the headmaster can prescribe him the kids. Now, I couldn't believe that, but I was told that by someone who was studying teaching, and
wow.
and she withdrew from the course. That's how she felt about it when she saw this type of thing going on in a school here in Sydney.
Well, there's no difference between really. I mean, Ritalin is very similar to cocaine, and it's actually called kiddie cocaine.
Right.
And it's a dangerous drug. You know, I mean, I'm sure there's people out there whose kids are on Ritalin and they're going, oh yes, but it's helped my children. And okay, I understand it's probably calmed them down and seen the right thing to do. But children have died on this drug.
Yeah.
And whether you feel that it's helped your child or not, are you willing to risk that? If even if it's 1% of kids, that 1% could be your child. Are you willing to risk that? I mean, kids have died from heart failure. They've had a heart attack because of the drugs.
It's just so tragic.
There's a whole lot of documented stuff on this, and it's just absolutely horrendous. And there are other alternatives. There are other solutions, and I think we should look at that a little bit later on, just what those solutions are, because that's what people say, you know. It's, oh, yes, but, you know, now my child can study because they're on Ritalin.
Yep.
They can concentrate. Well, the thing is like how much of, you know, sure, they might pass their exams, but are they going to be able to remember it or use any of the data?
Yeah, yeah. It's behavioural rather than anything that you would say. It's just about management. It's sort of like, yes, the child is now manageable. That would seem to be the criteria.
But even so, you know, in a lot of cases, the children aren't manageable, because we've got cases who come to us. See, one of the things that we do here is we actually help people document document cases so that they can put complaints in
right.
to the Healthcare Complaints Commission on psychiatrists who have put their kids on drugs or who have had any adverse drug reactions or whatever. We actually help them put the complaints in, because ultimately what we want to do is get legislation put in so that before anybody is given any label or any diagnosis or put on any drugs, they're given a full searching medical checkup. Because
right.
what, you know, through the research that we've done, between 50 to 60% of people who manifest a mental condition have an underlying undiagnosed medical condition.
Yeah.
And it's not spotted, it's not handled. You know, I mean, even someone getting, you know, the first stages of cancer can manifest as a mental condition. Right,
right.
Copper in your pipes at home, if you've got an old house and you've got copper leaching through, that's linked to depression. There's a whole list of them. Thyroid conditions, lead pesticide, you know, lead or pesticide poisoning, viral bacterial infections, malnutrition, allergies, head injuries, tumour, you know, mercury exposure, all of these things, you know, are just a very few can manifest as a mental illness.
And I'd just like to also point out that the pharmaceutical companies who make these drugs are, you know, typically in the top tier of the most powerful, richest companies in the world. They are the dominant corporate force in the world, along with you know, armaments manufacturers and a few other ones like that. The pharmaceutical companies, and of course, every time a new product is released, they're always, you know, wanting a new gold mine, and you know, they've been like these amazing drugs that have made them billions upon billions of dollars, like Prozac, like Viagra, you know. And actually, Viagra is another one I just wanted to mention briefly, because this again is a drug that's just been thrown at people without any proper consideration of what might really be needed, or what the person's problem really might be. And to the extent that it's just, you know, marketed on television in with cheeky ads, you know,
yeah.
And God knows what the side effects or unknown consequences of that are. But it's part of this pattern of just exploiting human beings, you know, with the use of a pill, for the sake of being able to sell them a commodity.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely out of control on every level, and
absolutely. And it's like, and they're using the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. I mean, that's been currently updated.
Yeah.
So it's like some of the disorders, you know, caffeine related disorder. Do you drink coffee?
Yeah. I try to. Yeah, I mean, I
how
like
many
to.
A day do you have beer? And I ask.
Well, I have a couple. You know, I usually have a couple. Yeah.
Well, just don't have too many, because you might have caffeine related disorder.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you have any problem writing things down. You could have a disorder of written expression, or there's conduct disorder, or mathematics disorder.
People who smoke
could have a nicotine use or withdrawal disorder.
I bet you, Kim, within a few years, they're going to bring out a conspiracy theory disorder for people who have conspiracy theories. Or maybe it already exists.
You better take my phone number. I'll come and rescue you.
Because there have been a lot of articles in recent years written in psychology magazines basically labelling people who believe in conspiracy theories as actually having some kind of form of mental illness. So certainly, and of course, you know, in Soviet Russia, people who criticized the government were actually diagnosed as having a type of schizophrenia. That was actually part of the mechanism. They were actually medicated, I think, weren't they?
Yeah. They certainly were, locked away, gulags. Medicated, shut up. You know.
Yeah. So,
and I have no doubt that it's being done as well. You know, like just even, for example, we get people call us and, you know, if I can't mention names, but we're working on a couple of cases at the moment. One lady's had her children taken away from her and by the Department of Community Services, and she was given a diagnosis of Munchausen.
Right.
Now, Munchausen is a disorder whereby presumably a mother, you know, sort of makes her children sick deliberately or, you know, something like that, and it's a made-up disorder. It's actually been totally debunked in the courts, in the Supreme Court in the UK.
Right.
And in here in Australia, there's people still being diagnosed with this Munchausen's disorder. Absolutely insane. Do you know what I mean? So it's like that happened to her quite a few years ago, and she's been going through the courts trying to get this original diagnosis looked at and discredited so that then she can go forward and get her kids back. She's still fighting to get her kids back. All because of a you know, disorder that she was, you know, a label that was put on her years ago.
Really.
So that's the sort of mad stuff that's happening out there. It's just not just mad, it's actually quite dangerous. And, you know, if it's just a conspiracy, then I'm afraid, you know, I'm a conspiracy theorist as well.
Yeah, you know? We all are. We all become conspiracy theorists as we start to face these unfortunate facts. And, you know, I'm really keen to take this beyond just the level that we're at now, where we sort of feel powerless, we feel toothless. You know, your organization's been going a long time, but there's a lot of new groups that have developed in the last few years, and we all need to come together now. We need to support each other on the key questions about the suppressions of freedom and the invasion of our rights. And the exploitation of us by corporate government, corporate alliances, which are sort of, you know, just basically, you know, alliances from hell. You know, that basically there is nothing that is good about them. It is an unhealthy situation that's developed, which we have to roll back. And I really think we're going to get to the point where we have to start getting out on the streets. We've got to have mass protests. We've got to have people angry enough to be willing to do that. And I'm really encouraging anyone who's listening to be angry enough to get out on the street. And, you know, I want to help make that happen. And that, of course, they can contact your organization. But, you know, we've got an organization that we support, wearechange.org.au. And we intend to actually do educational street actions where we have the information there. And we reach out to people because we've actually got to expand the awareness of this.
We do. We do need to expand the awareness of it. And I think there are so many issues out there. One of the things is, like, with our organisation, we stay within the guidelines of what you know, the policy of our organisation.
Yeah.
And we expose, you know, psychiatric, dangerous psychiatric treatments, and we, you know, get reforms done in that particular area. Because we believe that at the basis of a lot of the other things that are happening, the psychiatry is the problem. If you see our exhibit, the travelling exhibit, I don't think you've seen it, but it's not been in Sydney for the last 12 months, but be coming back soon. It's an expose of the history of psychiatry. And you can see there that it's infiltrated every area of society. And, you know, to the point where, like, you know, in our governments, in our health department, in our education system, in our religion, right across the all areas of society, you'll find psychiatry. And if psychiatry is taken out of those institutions and people really start looking and not just listening to psychiatrists, because what they're doing does not work. It's been shown over the last 100 years it doesn't work. The drugs don't work. People aren't getting better. We're paying more and more money, more and more millions. Like, you have a look at what Tony Abbott's, you know, proposing to, if he gets in, what he's proposing to give mental health in McGorry. And then you have a look at, you know, our auspicious, you know, Prime Minister, what she's willing to do as well. And they're just throwing money at this problem without really looking at what are the real solutions of it, you know, and let's put proper medical, educational
solutions in place.
You know, solutions in there.
Kim, we're going to have to wind up. I've got another interview coming on, unfortunately. I'd love to engage with you again on this subject. We've just sort of touched the surface.
We have, haven't we?
It's great to have you on. So CCHR, what's the website that people can contact there?
It's www.cchrnsw.org.au. And if they'd like to just have a look at our international website, it's just www.cchr.org. They can also email us at inquiry@cchrnsw.org or give us a call on 9560036. Now, also, I'd like to give you 10 copies of our newest documentary.
Oh, thanks.
Called Marketing of Madness.
Yeah, great, great.
And if you'd like to give them out or do what you like with them to, you know, to your listeners or anyone who would like to follow up on this and get other people aware of it. And if at some point you'd like to do a screening, then we can work something out on that as well. You know, I'd certainly love to work with you on that.
Yeah, we'll work that through. That sounds like a really interesting plan.
Mm.
Great. Well, look, thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Great. Okay, thanks. Talk soon.
Bye.
Cheers. Great. Well, that was Kim Cullen, and a really interesting little interview there. And I have a few minutes before my next guest comes on. So I'd just like to run through a couple more stories here while we've got a bit of time. In particular, I wanted to just give you a recap on Professor Niels Harrit, the lecture in Sydney, which took place on Saturday the 17th of August, sorry, of July, which was a big hit. It was a sellout house. Got a short article here, which was written by John Bursell. On Saturday the 17th of July, Professor Niels Harrit of the University of Copenhagen in Denmark gave a lecture to a capacity crowd of concerned citizens called "Did Explosives Bring Down the Towers on 9/11? The Sydney audience was generated purely from flyers handed out by diligent activists and one radio interview. Although a handful of independent journalists did attend and a small press conference was held, not one Australian mainstream media outlet was represented. It is now more clear than ever that a culture of silence surrounds the science of 9/11, which proves beyond any reasonable doubt that the Twin Towers and Building 7 were brought down using explosives and incendiary devices. The Australian 9/11 Truth Movement would like to thank all that made this event possible and their generous donations, which for the first time actually covered the costs. A special thanks must also go to the Sydney We Are Change chapter, who acted as the arms and legs to get this show on the road. Besides being a man of great knowledge, Niels Harrit is an absolute gem of a man that works hard for the 9/11 cause. Dr. Harrit has given in excess of 100 lectures to the public, both in Denmark and abroad. He is a modern-day scientific hero in a world of intellectual cowards and self-serving academics. International relationships within the 9/11 Truth Movement continue to build by these events, strengthening all our resolves to pursue truth and justice for the victims of the 9/11 attacks. And I think that article there by John summarizes it better than I could in any other way. So, terrific event. We're going to have the video has been shot and hasn't been edited yet, but it's going to be a great video presentation there to give to your friends and family to explain why it is, if you've got people that you wanted to reach out to, you want to give them something that's pretty hard to question, hard to doubt, you know, someone who's an expert with some very solid, carefully, you know, researched and very eloquently, you know, presented information there. So, yeah, it'll be an excellent DVD and a great step forward in this part of the world as well. So with that, I'm just going to take a quick break now. We'll have some music and then we'll be on with our next guest, Jarrah White. Please stand by. This is Amy Allen with her song, I'd Start a Revolution.
Why are we determined to follow a foreign policy of empire building and preemption which is unbecoming of a constitutional republic?
Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, welcome back to Truth News Radio. And for our second interview tonight, I have a guest who's joined us before. It's been almost a year, I think, since he was on the show. His name's Jarrah White, and he has a YouTube channel, and his organization is known as JW Studios, and he produces videos and documentaries which question various aspects of the Apollo moon missions, and he's done a huge number of them. Just looking at the YouTube channel here at the moment, there's quite a large number. I'm just trying to actually get it up. 395 uploads there. Jarrah, I'd just like to say welcome back to the show. It's great to have you aboard again.
Yeah, likewise. It's nice to be back here.
Excellent. Yes, the last time we spoke, we actually spoke, partly was triggered by my own kind of christening into sort of becoming a bit of a skeptic about Apollo. I'd always been kind of more or less gone along with it, because I don't like to question too many things, and I get into questioning a lot of stuff on this show. And the thing that kind of triggered it for me was actually that launch of the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, imagery, which was on BBC and various other news channels, and they'd said, you know, how amazing it was that we could actually see the remains of the Apollo missions. And I went to the website, the NASA website, and looked there, and, you know, wow, well, I saw a smudge, you know, and I zoomed in on it, and I saw like pixels, you know, and I thought, this is ridiculous. How can they on the news talk about this as if this is an amazing, you know, photographic coup to show you these photographs that show the presence of the Apollo missions on the moon? And then you go to the website and there's nothing there, there's nothing to look at. And that really got me thinking. It really got me, and it's sort of, it's their own fault, you know, like they shouldn't have even talked about it, because it they've just highlighted a problem there by doing that. And, you know, before we get into your recent research, I just want to know, has there been any more images from that orbiter, which is now, because when they initially did that news report, they said there's going to be even more amazing images coming soon, you know, of the human presence on the moon. Anything? Has there been anything?
The more recent, I believe that the first photographs that they took back when they first started hyping about it, I think that was, what, 100 kilometres or so above the lunar surface, and they didn't show much of anything.
Yeah.
Although when I did take a look at them, right, I compared them to some of the earlier photographs from like the Apollo 15 site, for example, that had been previously photographed by Cellini and Clementine and all the scientists had been hyping about this little bright region near the where they claimed the Apollo 15 landed. And they said, oh, this bright region, that must be the disturbance caused by the engine exhaust spreading out across the surface, you know, blasting all this dust all over the place. But when we looked at the LRO photos, we find out that this bright section is just a large impact crater that's near where they supposedly, you know, where they claim that the vehicle landed, you know, well, because there's no blast disturbance around it. Obviously, that's a fake. But returning to your question, yeah, has there been any new photos coming in? Well, yes, there has been. Recently, actually, it was more than a year ago. I've been a little sidetracked here and there. But yeah, they've been returning photos taken from about 50 kilometers above the surface. And they claim, oh, these ones are much more clearer than those before. Well, not really.
Right.
They're just the same pixelated garbage. They don't really show much of anything. And the fact that we should even be getting this garbage from 50 kilometers, okay, that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like, if you recall, the LRO has a resolution of about half a meter per pixel. Right,
right.
Well, in orbiting the Earth right now is the GOI-1, which is this satellite which, you know, takes high-resolution photographs around the same resolution. Yeah. And this satellite is about 800 kilometers above the Earth. You know,
right,
it has to look through the atmosphere. It has a much higher altitude. And, you know, and this thing has the exact same resolution as the LRO. And what it returns is pictures of cars, people,
yeah,
you know, people
detailed,
walking the streets,
yeah,
you know, walking a dog or whatever. You can clearly see that. It's on the web. You know, this is from GOI-1 at 800 kilometers, I think it is, 800 kilometers above the Earth, looking through all this atmosphere, seeing all these fine detail, yet LRO, 50 kilometers above the lunar surface, right, same resolution. What's all this junk that they're sending us? It doesn't make any sense.
Indeed. And, you know, I mean, you'd think it would be something really interesting for them if there was equipment there on the moon that's been there for, like, 40 years. it would be so interesting to actually study that and to see how it's weathered, you know, what's how it's been affected, you know, those moon buggies and things that they left behind. I mean,
yeah, exactly. It's funny you should mention the moon buggies as well, because, like, okay, when we look at the moon buggies, right, in the Hasselblad surface photos, you see all their very, you know, their white surfaces, you know, that look very reflective, look very bright and that sort of stuff in the pictures.
Yeah.
Right? But when we look at them, well, when we look at them, you know, in the LRO photos, what do we see? They look like the remains of a campfire. They're just these little black smudges.
Yeah.
It was the sun directly overhead, may I point out, directly overhead. You know, see how bright these, how shiny these things are. Well, why are they so dark when they're looking at them directly overhead? In fact, the same thing happened with the Surveyor 3 photograph. The Apollo 12 supposedly landed, you know, close by to the Surveyor 3, landed the unmanned craft. Now, in the first photos that they showed, the first 100-kilometer images, I forget the altitude right now, but in the original images of the Apollo 12 site, right, the Surveyor 3 appeared to be aligned differently. You know, it has two white boxes, the Surveyor 3, the actual craft has two white boxes on either side of the thing.
Right.
And then in the original picture of the Apollo 12 site, it appeared as two blobs.
Okay.
Sort of like a figure eight. Okay. And, okay, maybe these two blobs are those white boxes. Right. But when we compare it to the position, okay, here's where the Surveyor 3 is, and up here is where the Apollo 12 supposedly is. Hang on. The white boxes, or what appear to be the white boxes, are aligned differently from what they appear in the Hasselblad photographs.
That's interesting. Okay,
you know,
so
no,
there's something
yeah,
we
when
can.
We,
actually...
when they, and then when they showed the 500, sorry, when they showed the 50-kilometer altitudes, the so-called quote the better pictures with the sun directly overhead, now the Surveyor 3 appears in blackness.
Okay, yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, the quality is so poor. And there's nothing you could really distinguish there, is there? Like, there's no actual structures that you can distinguish.
No, not really. No.
So it's sort of useless from any real point of view. And it, you know, if they are totally lying about it, which I'm, you know, I'm not taking a position on this show that I'm saying that I am a full believer in what you're saying. But basically, the fact is that if they did want to cover something up, well, doing this pixelated imagery is a great way of just basically doing that while giving people the impression that, because I mean, obviously, the LRO is a real thing. I mean, and I accept that the orbiter is going around the moon, and they have to return some images. And of course, a lot of people would be wanting to see those images of the Apollo missions. Of course, it's going to be actually probably on the top of, you know, what people would want to see, because it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's like our presence on the moon, you know. I mean, people want to see the flag, probably, that they stuck in the ground there. But anyway, I mean, look, let's move on a little. Jared, what are you working on now, and what would you say is like your the main focus of your research and like over the last year since we last talked?
Well, a lot of the research has unfortunately been going kind of slowly because, like, if you recall, I had to fly overseas to attend the funeral of Ralph Rene.
Ah, right.
Yeah. And during the time there, the YouTube had quickly turned into Attack of the Trolls, to say the least. You know, because like many of my detractors, they said, you know, the rats will play when the mice are away, and so
indeed.
That's exactly what happened on YouTube as soon as I turned my back. And so, okay, just, you know, deal with these guys, couldn't respond to them, okay. But it just sort of slowed me down. But yeah, a lot of whole new stuff has been popping up since our last talk. Like,
could you just give a quick recap on who Ralph Rene is for our listeners who might not be aware of that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Ralph Rene, he was the author of the book NASA Mooned America, which is considered by many to be the most thorough and detailed book on the whole moon landing hoax.
Great, great. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, definitely one to look at then, yeah.
Yeah,
please continue.
He died in 2008, and he requested that his ashes be scattered in New Jersey, and so I had to fly overseas to attend the scattering. And so once I turned my back, everything, all the rats start playing, and so, okay, I have to respond to this, I have to reply to that, you know, because a lot of people just tell me to ignore them, but, you know, ignoring the propaganda won't make it go away, you know?
Yeah, and it can be important to address specific allegations that are made, I guess, if you feel that they're incorrect.
Yeah, pretty much. But I have been focusing on a whole lot of new material lately. Like, for example, I recently purchased 25 kilograms of the lunar regolith simulant, which is called JSC-1A. what it basically is, it's this this crushed basalts, and basically it's like it's supposed to be identical in identical, you know, or at least close enough to the quote real stuff.
Oh, excellent! Yes, I've seen that that video of yours where you, and you used that to do the boot print, didn't you?
That's correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
The your listeners might have seen the recent MythBusters episode about the moon missions. On that program, they tried to simulate the can you create blueprints on the moon? Like one of the anomalies that Ralph Ranade pointed out in his book was the fact that we see all these clear blueprints in deep soil, and I want to emphasize the word deep. You know, like we see blueprints, you know, about like 2 inches deep, right?
Yeah.
And you know, that you need water to do that. And now, what they had been claiming on the show was that, oh, well, the particles are very, very sharp, and so therefore they can naturally stick together that way. But what they did in the simulation is that they only dug their boot about a few millimeters deep. You know, no one denies that you'll get a blueprint, you know, at a few millimeters deep. You know, what we question is how is like two inches or 3 inches deep, which is what they show in the Apollo photographs.
Yeah.
So I decided to redo the experiment that they did. So I ordered some of the regular simulant. If any of your listeners want to order some of it, you can get it off the from the company Orbit Tech, which is the company that manufactures this stuff for NASA. You know, they sell it also to the public. And I picked some up. And so, okay, I tried to dig my boot in about 2-3 inches, and what happens? The dust, it just collapses in on itself.
Okay, so just to simplify this for the uninitiated, what we're saying here is that the astronauts' boots shouldn't have left a clear imprint.
Exactly.
Should have been kind of a smudgy imprint, but yet when we look at the photographs, they're absolutely crisp, aren't they?
You can see the lines in the soles of the boots and stuff like that. They should have. If you ever go down to the beach when you're walking in the dry sand, how that constantly collapses in itself. That's pretty much the exact same effect that I got in this lunar regolith simulant. And so we should have seen stuff like that in the Apollo boot print photos, but we don't. We see these crystal clear boot prints, you know, probably done for propaganda purposes, and it just can't be done.
Yeah, I really have to admit that the boot evidence is quite startling, because of course it implies that the sand was wet, and obviously that's not possible on the moon. And the MythBusters episode tried to get around that by saying, well, if it's very sharp, if it's not like sand, like comes from Earth, and something about being in a vacuum as well, somehow you can get that sort of crisp boot print. And they did it in a vacuum chamber, but as you say, that was just like a half inch or so of
a couple millimeters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you make it shallow enough, even dry sand will leave a print. You know, you leave dry sand a few millimeters. You know, but if you're trying to get inches deep, which is like what they showed in the photographs, it's not going to work.
And the thing I was unclear about with the MythBusters episode was what would be the difference between doing it in a vacuum and not in a vacuum. It's hard to get a clear idea of how being in a vacuum changes the way the boot print would work.
The use of the vacuum chamber was to remove any moisture that might have been in the chamber at the time. Because you create a vacuum right there, it lowers the boiling point of water.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that would boil it away in seconds.
Of course, yeah, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, which also leads to more problems with what NASA has been claiming, like the analysis of the moon rocks. Right, for years, geologists have been finding, you know, water in the Apollo samples, you know, and they'd always say, oh well, it's probably just terrestrial contamination, you know, and then recently they find evidence that there's all this water in these lunar spherules. And then they think, okay, well maybe there is water in the moon, you know. And now suddenly, all of a sudden, they're finding vast quantities of water from their satellites. You know,
right.
You know, because like it's preposterous because as I said, any water would boil away in seconds in the vacuum of space because it's a vacuum up there. And
well, that's a really interesting point. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of news stories about. Claiming that there's a lot of frozen water on the moon. And yet even frozen, even ice is going to just evaporate really quickly, isn't it? It's not going to...
Yeah, the temperatures on the lunar surface are about 100 degrees Celsius.
Right.
That's during the daylight hours.
Okay, yeah, yeah. That's pretty warm.
Yeah, even the moon rocks themselves, you know, totally aside from the fact that they've got water in them, you analyze them, you chemically you find out that they're, you know, virtually identical to the most basic kind of rock on Earth, the basalt, you know, and they're almost chemically identical to the basalt. You know, they have the same composition of minerals. They're mostly silicon dioxide, you know. You just find all these similarities, right, to Earth rocks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, well, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and smells like a duck, it's a duck. You
most
know?
Likely.
So these things are so similar to Earth rocks. You know, what's that telling you?
And if the sun's beating down on a rock on the surface of the moon that's got a bit of water in it, at that sort of temperature, well, the water inside is going to be vaporized, and the rock's probably going to explode or something, isn't it? I mean, you know,
would happen. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you just actually did take one of those actual rocks that has water in it and stick it on the moon, it'd be quite, in a vacuum in space in the bright sunlight. I don't know what would happen.
It's worth checking out. The fact that they're finding water on the moon with all their satellites now, it's preposterous. Preposterous, because like the moon is a vacuum, right? It's extremely hot up there.
Mm.
You know, it would evaporate all the water vaporize all the water that's on there. And in fact, you also might recall as well, they found that Dutch moon rock in the museum, which turned out to be petrified wood.
Yeah, and so what's the explanation for that?
From what I understand, I've been trying to find the official investigation on that. I haven't been able to find it yet, Lee, but what I've communicated with various individuals from museums, you know, who are like have their own collection of moon rocks on display, you know, and everyone I've talked to, they seem to think, oh, it must have been a case of mistaken identity.
Right, well, right.
Yeah, right. You've been given this piece of rock from an astronaut who supposedly went to the moon, you know. What's the guy supposed to think? You know, it's crazy that they would think, oh, they'd just give them petrified wood. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
It's hard to imagine how they could make a mistake.
Exactly. In fact, I actually spoke to. I always wondered since my first video on moon rocks. I always wondered, maybe does NASA have two batches of moon rock? Do they give this batch derived from all the Earth rocks to the scientists, and they just give some random piece of junk to the museums, because you know they don't need to know or care about its chemical composition, its minerals, etc. You know, they just put it on display for show purposes. So I always wondered. So I contacted various museums to try to find out if they had any of their moon rocks analyzed. And right. As far as I can tell you, there were none.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I contacted the Powerhouse Museum, which has an Apollo 16 rock on display that's in Sydney, and they told me that we didn't have it analyzed, but we did receive all the paperwork that came with it. I contacted this one museum in the UK, I forget the name of it right now, and they said, oh, we didn't analyze it, it was sealed in glass, we couldn't analyze it, so even if we wanted to analyze it, we couldn't.
Because it was actually sealed.
Yeah. Now I did speak to the Air and Space Museum, which has a whole variety of moon rocks on display. They said that they did have a geologist analyze them, but that geologist was, you know, closely working with NASA.
Right, right, okay.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really help too much, does it?
It doesn't really help, you know, because like I'm trying to find out, did any of these guys have it, you know, analyzed independently and stuff?
Does Australia have any moon rocks? Do you know, Jarrah? Are there any? You know, rocks here that we've got in museums.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Are there any actual alleged moon rocks in Australia? Like, were any donated to Australian museums or?
Yeah, as I said before, the Powerhouse Museum has an Apollo 16 moon rock in on display there.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, and I believe it's a sample of Big Muley, which is the largest moon rock that was ever allegedly collected.
So how big is that one?
It's only a small chunk of it. It's about the size of a
about the size of a mandarin. The sample that they've got, the actual rocket it came from is much larger, from what I understand. But the rock sample they got on display is about the size of a mandarin. I've seen it a few times at the museum.
Interesting. If a government at some point wanted to investigate this, there are ways. And I sometimes wonder, what the Russians might know or what they might have to say about this. Because if anyone would know what the truth of it is, the Russians would, because they obviously had a space program. They chose not to go to the moon.
They had a space program. In fact, they actually contacted you've heard of the British scientist, have you, Sir Bernard Lavell?
I don't know the name.
British astronomer.
Tell me more. Yeah.
Yeah, he actually visited the Russians in 1963, I think it was, and they showed him all their observatories, all their equipment, all the stuff they were building and stuff like that, and they specifically told him that this is a direct quote, the Russians could see no immediate way of protecting cosmonauts from the lethal effects of solar radiation.
Interesting.
Okay, they told him that, and they said, go tell NASA that. And so he did, but they went right ahead and with their moon program. And some years after the moon project, the Russians, the Americans, in fact, you might have seen this on the news last night, the anniversary of the ASTP, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, which was the first joint space mission. Nowadays these guys are all working together, all collaborating together. In fact, all the space nations, except for the Chinese, which incidentally happen to be America's best trade partner, they all seem to be working together in space exploration with the Americans.
Yeah.
Like now we've got the International Space Station, we had the Mir program, we've got all these various payloads that the Americans are launching into space, and, payloads from other countries, of course. And so it's just like a one-world space government is what it is.
And I just want to throw at you the question that's always thrown at this point by those who are sort of the debunkers of so-called conspiracy theories, is that they always say this is ridiculous because no one can keep secrets in such an incredible way. And this has come up in many different areas that I've investigated.
Yeah.
And it's an argument that's always used to basically rule out the possibility of a giant conspiracy, because they say, there would have been a leak, there would have been a whistleblower, you can't just pull the wool over people's eyes like that. What do you have to say to that?
Well, there's two things I have to say to that. First is that the fact that secrets involving that many people have historically been kept under wraps all this time. All one needs to look to is the N1 moon project, which was basically the Soviet equivalent of the Apollo project. They were building this gigantic Saturn-sized rocket, in utmost secrecy. This involved thousands and thousands of engineers and scientists and stuff like that. All these people involved in this construction and designing of this rocket.
Yeah.
Okay. This enormous secret project designed to win the moon race. They tested the N1 four times. It failed. Right. That project was kept under wraps for 30 years until the Soviet Union collapsed.
Right. Right.
Yes.
So this was kept under wraps by the Russians.
By the Russians, yes. Mm. This was the N1 project. They had two huge projects designed to win them the moon race. The L1 project, which was a proposal to send a stripped-down Soyuz around the moon and back. And another project, the L3 project, which is also known as the N1 project, which was to send a crew to the lunar surface. But, of course, that bailed on them. And, in fact, there was actually pleas there from the cosmonauts, Alexei Leonov. He was leading this one group of cosmonauts. He was pleading them to pilot the, I think it was the Zond 7. It was either the Zond 7 or the Zond 6. I forget which right now. But basically, he was pleading with his Russian masters, okay, why don't we fly this around the moon before the Americans do? And the Russians say, no, we are absolutely not sending you guys to the moon until we can be absolutely sure you guys will survive. Basically like that.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't deny that the Russians would have tried to fake their own moon project, but what reasons unknown, they never got around to doing it. Although they did put a taped recorder in one of their capsules, which they sent around the moon with the voice of a cosmonaut coming back. I think the voice was Pavel Popovich's voice. They sent a probe around they sent one of their Zond craft around the moon with that voice. Had they not revealed that voice was just a taped recorder, they might have been able to claim that they sent a man around the moon.
Right.
So I don't deny that they would have tried. But anyways, the fact is, this program involved all these people, and it remained covered up until the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Okay, and the second thing I'd like to point out is that not everyone at NASA, as is claimed by the trolls, as the propagandists claim, that not everyone at NASA needs to know about the conspiracy.
Yeah.
Like the guys at Houston, all they do is they just sit at their computer, you know, read what's on the screens, and make decisions based on the data. Now, they don't need to know or care where the data comes from. In fact, they're actually trained with simulated data. I actually posted a video about this just a few hours ago. You can find it on my YouTube channel. Basically, what they do is they just sit there at the monitors and read what's on the screens. They don't have to know or care where the data comes from. Okay, and the simulations that they did for training purposes were so real that no controller could distinguish the training from an actual mission. Right, so all NASA would need to do is relay simulated data over the landlines to the guys at Houston, right, and no one's the wiser. One's the wiser.
What about the claim, and I've had this thrown at me, that sort of independent ham radio operators would have been able to intercept the signals to know that basically these signals weren't really coming from space.
But I managed to track down all the testimonies of all these various different ham radio operators, and I actually met up with one of them in person. I forget his name right now, but it's on my YouTube channel. You can all see that.
Sure.
But all these guys seem to have one thing in common. None of them can attest to having tracked these vehicles all the way to the moon and back, as the believers in the moon landings have claimed.
Right.
Instead, all they have a claim to is been able to track it when it was on or near the moon, you know, so like say in lunar orbit or on the surface or whatever. Okay? And so, you know, that's nothing that can't be pulled off with an unmanned craft, you know, to either relay signals from Earth orbit or transmit pre-filmed information.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and furthermore, right, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, they actually declared it illegal for hams or anyone else to inform the world of information that was not intended for public view.
That's interesting.
Basically, the FCC was policing what these ham radio operators can and cannot release to the public, what they received from Apollo. They're basically policing what they can and cannot use, cannot show to the public.
Now, would these operators have been able to actually get the signal of the transmissions of the video? Was that actually feasible? I mean, would a ham radio operator have been able to read that?
From what I understand, all they were able to receive from the moon was just some telemetry data, and it wasn't until Apollo 15, I think, that they actually received voice signals. I've never heard of a ham receiving videos.
I see. Right. So again, there's nothing there that could really prove. Although I guess a voice signal. it's interesting. I mean, of course, if you're not disputing that they were able to actually put a spacecraft around the moon, the question is were there people in it?
I don't deny that you can put people around. Sorry, put spacecraft around the moon, but putting manned spacecraft around the moon—that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of really detailed things there that it's hard to actually clarify. Look, one other thing. I just point out is that the space program, the moon mission, has been delayed again indefinitely, and they're now talking about a mission to Mars. But
I actually released a video about that just recently.
Oh, great!
Yeah, it's called "What Proof Is Required." Here's the story basically. Okay, it's 2003, the Columbia disaster. You know, happens, and basically, Bushy basically proposes, okay, we're going to be going back to the moon. You know, I believe that he just proposed that, you know, just to get reelected. You know, because this was in 2004 when he made that proposal. You know, trying to get reelected.
Sure.
And stuff. And now Obama's stuck with this decision, and he says, oh, well, you can't go back to the moon because it's too expensive. This was in March, I think it was. He said it's too expensive. We can't go back. It's too expensive. No, sorry, it was February. February said this. We can't go back to the moon because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is quite weird because, like, when the project was first announced, it was announced it was going to be cheaper than the Shuttle project and about 55% the cost of the previous moon mission.
Yeah.
The previous, you know, the Apollo missions. Well, the Apollo program in 21st century currency that cost $135 billion.
Yeah.
When you do the math, it turns out that the Constellation project would have cost only $74.25 billion.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's about $74 billion. So that's much cheaper than what the Apollo project was. Now, when it was, by the time it was cancelled, right, they'd had spent only about $10 billion on it.
Hmm.
You know, so, and he's telling me that's too expensive. You know, they spent $135 billion on the Apollo project, and another $145 billion on the shuttle project. You know, so.
I think it doesn't make sense.
It's not a matter of budget, you know. But then later on in April, right, he has been receiving a whole lot of criticism, you know, from various guys at NASA. Because if you understand, right, at the moment they have no return, no launch vehicles, and because they're gonna be cancelling the shuttle soon, and the Ares project has been cancelled, from what I understand, and so they're still, you know, deciding which launch vehicle they're going to use to replace the shuttle with. And so basically, there's a whole lot of jobs, you know, at all these NASA facilities that were going to get lost, you know. And so he probably just proposed, I'm putting the space program back on, but we're skipping the moon. We're heading straight off to the asteroids and Mars and that sort of stuff, which has led to a lot of controversy because, like, all the proposals for space exploration that I've read, you know, talk about using the moon as a stepping stone to get to Mars.
Indeed, you know?
But then this is the whole point. First of all, he says, okay, it's too expensive to go to the moon. Now he's saying, okay, we've been there, done that, let's go to Mars now.
It seems just irrational. It seems like crazy.
Yeah,
crazy
it is irrational
talk.
Because, like, first of all, a trip to Mars is obviously going to be a whole lot more expensive than a moon flight will be.
Sure.
You know, because, like, you're sending astronauts out there for years on end. You know,
to me, it's kind of like a parent saying to a kid, you know, like, you know, you know, the kid says, you promised me we were going to go to Luna Park on the weekend, and the parent says, don't worry, we're going to go to Disneyland next year. You know, it's like, it's sort of humoring the average person, and I think regardless of your position on the Apollo missions, you've got to see that for what it is. It's just political posturing.
Yeah, you know. Pretty much. And the whole most likely reason why, first, it's another thing too, is that they always seem to set the launch dates for these missions. They always seem to set them so far into the future. Like when back during the Apollo days, they were talking about putting people on Mars by 1982.
Right, right.
Yeah, we didn't know how that went.
Yeah.
And then Bush Sr., he proposes a moon flight by, I think it was 2010, I think it was.
Sure, well, yeah.
It's the year 2010 now. I still don't see anyone on the moon yet. And then Bush Jr. comes along and he says, okay, we'll have people on the moon by 2020. That's canned now. And then now Obama says, okay, we'll be going to Mars by the year 2035, something like that. And, you know, the most likely reason why they're constantly, you know, pushing it so far into the future, the launch dates, is because we still don't have the technology to get humans safely beyond low Earth orbit because of all the radiation that's encountered in space.
Indeed. And, you know, by the year 2035, the whole generation of people who are increasingly skeptical now, including me, I mean, we'll all be, you know, getting older and older, and a lot of them will be dead. And you know, once you get rid of that generation of people, then you can basically quietly erase history.
You know, you might as well have just said we'll be on the moon by the year 2090.
Indeed.
So even if it didn't happen, you know, we'd all be dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Better to be a mystery than to be wrong.
Yeah. It's so true. Look, there's definitely something fishy going on here, and I think you're doing a really great job. I mean, someone's got to do it, and you're holding up your end there from Australia. Kudos to you for that, Jarrah.
Thanks.
You're going to have to wind up. I encourage our listeners to check out your latest stuff. Any particular productions you'd like to recommend? The Moon Boot one, would that be a good one to
whet
the appetite?
Yeah, the Moon Boot film is called Footprints on the Moon Set, Ralph Rene Was Correct.
Sure.
And the one that we were just talking about the new proposal to go to Mars, etc., that's in the film, What Proof Is Required, What Proof is Required. You can find out there. It's a five-part series, and I've got a few others. You know, I just released this new one, Tetra. What Tetra, which is the one I was telling you about, the how MCC controllers can be fooled and that sort of stuff.
Excellent.
And in fact, I actually recently released this new one. I've got it's called Did Jarra White Quote Mine the Mythbusters? A lot of people have accused me of claiming that I misrepresented the Mythbusters, you know, because like the Mythbusters, when they were talking about the laser reflectors,
they
said it was impossible to bounce lasers off the moon's bare surface. Well, we bounced them off the moon's bare surface before we had the Apollo 11 up there, and so a lot of people claimed, oh, I took them out of context. Well, recently I met up with Adam Savage at this convention in Las Vegas, and I was able to confirm with him, yeah, he did think that it was impossible to bounce them off the moon's bare surface, and, you know... So that's pretty cool to check out.
That's excellent. That's really important. I'll definitely have a look at that.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much for coming on tonight, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, thanks a lot. In fact, I've got a few films coming up, so keep an eye on my channel. There'll be more up there soon.
Great, yeah, and we'll have show notes with all of that available on the site. Yep. Okay, thanks a lot, Jarra.
No problem.
Cheers. Okay, well, that was another... really interesting interview. Not your usual kind of talk show stuff. Really steps out of kind of the accepted domain of discourse that we get from radio and television. But that's, you know, that's what you get when you have a free society and you've got a free internet and you've got even a handful of people prepared to look at things from a new perspective. I'm not saying that Jarrah's right. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm saying there's something extremely fishy going on here with the whole story about Apollo and our current, you know, inability to get to the moon and our inability to even get decent images from our orbiting satellites, with all the best quality, latest high-tech equipment that they've got now. They still can't get us a decent image of a moon buggy. So with that, I'll leave you to ponder those thoughts, and I look forward to hearing your comments, and I'll be speaking to you again next week. Good night from Truth News Radio Australia.